All right, everybody, welcome to another deep dive with us. And today, we're going to be getting into something, you know, a little provocative, let's say. We're diving into the Dictator's Handbook.
Ooh.
Yeah, you know, I know, right off the bat, that title might sound a little intimidating to some people, but stick with us. Because trust me, it is chock full of really interesting insights about how leaders, and this is the key, no matter what kind of system they're running, how they gain power, how they hold on to power, the mechanics of it all.
Yeah, and you know what I think is so interesting about this book? What makes The Dictator's Handbook so useful is that it approaches the whole thing, not from this kind of like moralistic standpoint, like, is this leader good? Is this leader bad? It's really about the framework, right?
Yeah.
It's a framework for understanding.
It's the how. It's not the should it be, it's the is.
Right. And the authors of this really compellingly argue that, you know, the same logic essentially applies whether you're talking about, you know, a democracy like the United States or you're talking about an autocracy. I think that's kind of a unique way of looking at this.
Right, because we often compartmentalize. And yeah. The book really does a great job, I think, of laying out these different groups.
Right.
Right. And how it all kind of functions. So we've got, and we've all heard these terms before, but they really crystallize them in this book. You've got the nominal selectorate, which is everybody who's eligible to kind of have a say. Mm-hmm. And so all the voters in a country, for example. And then you've got the real selectorate, mm-hmm. which is a much smaller group. This is who actually chooses the leader,
yeah.
right? So, you know, if you're talking about the U.S., you're talking about, you know, major party members, you're talking about people with a lot of influence, donors.
Yeah.
But then they've got this other group, which is, in my opinion, kind of the linchpin of the whole thing. And it's the winning coalition.
The winning coalition. Because you're right. It's not about pleasing everybody. It's about pleasing
right.
that group that's going to keep you in power.
That core group.
And the winning coalition really is that essential group.
Mm-hmm.
The book argues that almost every significant action a leader takes can be kind of almost boiled down to keeping that winning coalition happy.
Yes.
And on their side.
So let's dig into that a little bit because, okay, we're talking about dictatorships, we're talking about democracies.
Yeah.
Obviously, the size of those winning coalitions are going to be radically different.
Yeah.
So how does that actually play out differently, you know, in those two different systems?
That's exactly right. It all boils down to the numbers.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about an autocracy where that winning coalition is very small, it's very concentrated, what you often see is that leaders can maintain power through what the book calls private goods. And this is direct bribery. This is special favors. It's a very direct kind of transaction.
Right, very quid pro quo.
But in a democracy where you have a much larger winning coalition, you're not going to be able to buy off, you know, millions of people with, you know, a suitcase full of cash. So what you have to do is turn to public goods. And these are things like big infrastructure projects, social programs, you know, policies that are going to benefit, you know, a much wider swath of people.
Which it just reminded me of something else in the book that I found really fascinating. And it was talking about how in these small coalition systems, coups are much more common. And it made me think, well, yeah, if your grip on power hinges on keeping, you know, 10 people happy or 100 people happy, right, losing even a handful of those can be catastrophic. And so suddenly it's like these really extreme measures that we see in these autocratic systems make a lot more sense.
Absolutely. And it creates, I think, you know, this atmosphere where even if, you know, someone's not actively plotting against you, right, just the possibility.
Right.
The fear that losing even a small number of those essential backers can completely remove you from your position of power creates this environment of paranoia.
Instability.
Instability. And so, yeah, I mean, coups almost become kind of this logical consequence.
It's like you can see the almost cold calculation behind it when you start to really sort of break it down like that.
Right.
And you know what I think is fascinating is we can even take this outside of just strict dictatorships. We can think about, you know, even in the U.S. system, you know, the emphasis that gets placed on those first few primaries.
Yeah.
How much emphasis, you know, U.S. presidential candidates place yeah. on trying to win over voters, let's say, in Iowa? Because in a sense, they're trying to secure elements of that winning coalition very early on.
Exactly. I mean, think about something like foreign aid, right? Like we have this conception that foreign aid is, you know, wealthy countries helping poor countries. And of course, there's, you know, an element of that. But The Dictator's Handbook really compellingly argues that a lot of the times, you know, foreign aid might not be so much about altruism, yeah. right? It might not even be about kind of, you know, actually helping the people in those countries as much as it is about, you know, looking good, the leader, the donor country leader, looking good to their winning coalition back home.
Right, right. It's such a shift in perspective to kind of start viewing these things through that lens.
Yeah.
And then I start thinking about, you know, they use the example, the book of the Falklands War, mm-hmm. which, you know, if you're not familiar, Argentina's leader at the time was facing a lot of domestic unrest.
Right.
And then kind of, you know, out of seemingly nowhere, you know, picks a fight with the UK over these islands.
Because it's a way of sort of changing the conversation.
Right.
It's a distraction.
It's a rallying point, right?
Yeah. And it's a way to kind of, you know, especially when we're talking about a system where that coalition is so small and their grip on power is so precarious.
Right.
It's much more tempting to kind of make those very drastic moves. Right. To hold on.
Right. It makes you wonder how many other conflicts we could look back on throughout history and go, I wonder, you know,
right.
I wonder if that was part of the calculation there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, in the interest of fairness, we should acknowledge that, you know, the book does receive some criticism. Right. And I think one of the criticisms is that some people feel that it is, you know, maybe overly focused on these kind of power dynamics and this, you know, almost like cold, rational behavior, and that it doesn't always leave a lot of room for things like, you know, ideology or even genuine altruism. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that? Because obviously those things do play a role, right? It can't just be this cut and dry all the time.
Sure.
Or can it?
Well, that's definitely a simplification of reality, right? I don't think anybody would argue that it's not. But I think often that's kind of the point of models like this, right? Is to provide, you know, this framework that we can then use, you know, this lens through which we can then view the world, you know, and try to kind of understand, okay, well, if these are the basic mechanics at play, how can we understand, you know, these really complex patterns, these complex events that we see happening in the real world? And, you know, it doesn't mean that leaders are never altruistic or that they're never motivated by, you know, genuinely held beliefs. But what it does do, I think, is it helps us kind of understand why in certain situations they may act differently than we would expect them to if they were acting, you know, based purely on those ideals.
Right, because we all like to think, oh, well, they're just doing it because, you know, they believe in X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. But I think this helps us understand what those motivating factors might be,
mm-hmm.
you know, a little more clearly sometimes.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if you walk away from this book,
yeah,
and you don't agree with every single argument, which I don't think anybody does with any book.
Right.
It definitely gives you a lot to chew on.
It does.
And I think it really kind of shifts your perspective on things a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, something to leave everybody with, as you're thinking about this winning coalition idea, you know, think about your own country. Think about the leaders in your own country. Think about who are those essential groups that they really seem to be beholden to.
Hmm.
The people whose support they absolutely can't afford to lose. And how might that be influencing, you know, the decisions that those leaders are making?
It's a great question. It's a question all of us, you know, should be thinking about, right? Because it can help make us, you know, hopefully more informed citizens, more engaged citizens. You know, whether we agree or disagree with the decisions that are being made, you know, at least we're starting to understand the foundation on which they're being made.
Exactly. And that's what we're always aiming for here.
Absolutely.
Is just to kind of ask those interesting questions.
Yeah.
And get people thinking a little bit deeper about these things.
Absolutely.
Well, until next time, keep on diving, everybody.
Yeah. See you later.